This is an interview with Dick Walker for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm William Thomas. The date is May 14th, 2015, and we're in New York City. So thanks very much for agreeing to speak with us. We usually start with a little bit of biography just to get a sense of where you're coming from. So where are you from, and how did you make your way into law?
I was born in Wilmington, Delaware in 1950. And lived there my entire childhood, then left for college in the late 60s, attended Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, and then Temple Law School in Philadelphia. And I believe there was probably a pretty tumultuous time when I was in college before I went to law school. It was the height of the Vietnam War. There were lots of anxieties about going off and fighting in a war that not a lot of people understood. And there were some uncertainties about whether there would be continued deferrals after college. And I actually, when I was in college, I had a low draft number. I was drafted and had a physical exam in New Haven, Connecticut, which I passed, notwithstanding asthma, which was a prevalent condition that I suffered from. And ultimately, right after graduation, that decision had been reversed. I think they relooked at the medical records and decided that the asthma was a disqualifier. And so I had a very short period of time to make decisions about what I wanted to do since I wasn't going into the service. And Temple Law School, which was close by where I grew up, Wilmington, in the summer, right before the fall classes began, accepted me and said that I'd be welcome to attend classes. So that's what led me to law, a new reprieve after not getting drafted.
What did you study as an undergrad?
I studied English and German, interestingly enough. The German was just kind of fell into place, but I was primarily an English major.
Okay. And so then I see that after you got your JD, that was 1975, you were a law clerk.
I was. I clerked for the chief judge of the Third Circuit Court of Appeal, Colin Seitz, who was a wonderful man and a great mentor. He had formerly been the chancellor of Delaware Chancery Court, which was a very important court, continues to be an important court today for corporate law and corporate governance matters. And he was quite a legend, certainly in Delaware. He was one of Delaware's leading figures, and took a stab and applied to him. I think the fact that I was from Wilmington caught his eye and his attention, and he interviewed me and hired me as law clerk.
Okay. Had you been planning on doing the corporate law area?
I was primarily interested in the corporate law area, and probably part of it was because, as a Wilmingtonian, corporate law is such a part of the fabric of Wilmington, and no matter what you do with large corporates that were domiciled in Delaware, there was often a lot of things that you'd read about in the newspaper, and there was a lot of attention paid to corporate law, and I think Delaware has always been recognized as a center of corporate law, so I had a lot of exposure to it and maybe just gravitated to that naturally.
Okay. And then after that, you joined a law firm.
I did, yes. I joined a firm in New York City, Cadwallader, Wickersham & Taft, and I spent 15 years there, first as a litigation associate and then as a partner for the last 7 or 8 years.
Okay. Tell me about some of the things that you would have seen there that would have eventually led into securities.
Well, I saw a lot. I had a very broad and diverse practice. I can remember some crazy types of things. I did handled the eviction for a real estate client of the Rolling Stones' former manager. And so that was sort of at the one end of the scale. And then I did work in some SEC investigations on behalf of clients. That was very interesting work. I always thought it was interesting at the time. It was work that got your heart racing because you never knew what the outcome were, what the consequences were going to be. But I saw it, and both the subject matter and the process were very, very interesting to me. I had a diverse group of other types of cases. I remember one case we represented Holiday Inn, which was seeking insurance coverage for a hotel that they operated in Beirut, Lebanon, which had been absolutely decimated in the all too frequent fighting in Beirut. And I remember the issue came down to whether the damage was caused by civil war, which would have meant that it was a excluded apparel, or whether it was caused by, quote, riot, strike, or civil commotion. So believe it or not, the entire trial centered on whether this was a civil commotion or a civil war. And we won. So that was the good news. We proved it was a civil commotion.
Very interesting. So, of course, the 1980s was a very interesting time in the securities area. Did you see any cases in the insider trading tender offer area that was so big at the time?
I had some in my private practice. I was involved in some civil tender offer disputes. We handled one on behalf of Household Financial Corporation, and that was sort of my first taste of the tender offer area. Very interesting legal area. Very high stakes because it's fast moving and events are happening. So it's not one of the kinds of areas where there's a slow resolution of something over 10 years. These cases are decided oftentimes on temporary restraining orders and things of that sort. And I also was involved in some SEC insider trading investigations from the client point of view, which were also, again, very, very interesting. It was the Milken-Boesky era where, of course, insider trading was gaining such prominence. It was about the time that Jim Stewart wrote his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Den of Thieves. So it was a very exciting area full of colorful scoundrels, if you will, and colorful individuals, and then made famous in Stewart's book, great stories about how these cases were made and developed. So it was a very interesting, prominent area during the 80s.
Okay. Anything else that we should deal with from that time of private practice, or should we move into the SEC time?
No, I think that's probably it. I have to say that during periodically private practice, the lure of public service attracted me, and I had an unsuccessful flirtation with being an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. That never quite eventuated, and I think I made a pass at the Solicitor General's office in Washington. I made an application there, but the places and the number of people that they hire in that office are very, very small. And I always had the interest and attraction to public service is something that I wanted to do. And I had always been interested in the SEC. One of my close law school classmates, Bill McLucas, had a very successful career in Washington in the enforcement division. And he and I compared notes periodically and got to revel in some of the excitement that he was involved in. So that the SEC was something that was always quite interesting and fascinating to me. And I remember, I guess it was probably 1990, there was a small little notice in the Wall Street Journal that the head of the SEC's New York office had announced that he was stepping down. And I called Bill and I asked him what he thought about that job. I said, most of the time we all see and hear about the enforcement division in Washington, D.C., is the New York office a backwater office? Is that a real serious, substantial office? What would you think if I was interested in that and wanted to apply for that position? And he said there were some terrific people in the New York office, that they had had some personnel issues over the years, but that they had fabulous, great people, and just it would be kind of like rubbing two sticks together to get flames started. And he encouraged me to throw my hat into the ring, which is what I did. And I applied for the then I believe it was called regional director's position. And lo and behold, I was successful. I was appointed regional director in the fall of 1991.
Okay. There was, on your resume, it said that your original title was administrator and then director. Was that just a title change?
That's right. It was basically a bit of a title change and also a bit of a change in responsibilities, too. Originally, I guess you're right, I was regional administrator for the New York region. New York was a separate region. And then when Chairman Leavitt was appointed several years later, he combined Boston, Philadelphia, and New York into a region and changed my title to regional director of the Northeast region rather than just the New York region. I think today it may have actually changed back. I think New York may be a standalone region now, but it was I was basically the senior commission official for first New York and then New York, Boston, and Philadelphia.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about the responsibilities of the New York office, especially vis-a-vis what was going on in Washington.
Sure. The regional offices really performed two, and at that time actually three functions, but primarily the regional offices were responsible for enforcement and inspections. And the inspection program, this was before OC was created, so inspections were done on a more decentralized basis. Each of the regions had inspection staffs that would conduct inspections of registered entities in their region, which is what we did. And we had probably half our staff was inspection type of inspection related staff. And we also had enforcement staff who would bring cases. And over time, the enforcement authority was more centralized through Washington. Under Chairman Breeden, he wanted all of the regional enforcement recommendations reviewed by the division's chief counsel, who was at the time Colleen Mahoney, when I first started. And so we brought enforcement cases, we did inspections, and then there was a very small group, branch of small issues that would do review of filings for certain kinds of corporate issuances. That subsequently was taken back by Washington. So the regional offices didn't have the full scope of policymaking and other activities that the headquarters had in Washington. It was primarily focused on the items that I've mentioned.
Okay, about how big was the office when you were there?
Oh, boy. I believe that there were probably about 120 when I started. It might have been actually a little bit bigger than that. And it grew incrementally over the years. I don't know what the number is now. I'm sure it's much larger. But it was a large regional office. I think the commission's largest office at the time because of New York's mm-hmm. proximity to financial markets and the stock exchange. So it was always a big, very active office of the commission.
Yeah, that was going to be the next thing that I was going to ask about is being in the New York office versus the other regional offices. Are there special responsibilities of that office that one wouldn't see?
Interestingly enough, the answer is yes. We used to take a very aggressive stance vis-a-vis our jurisdiction. So we would with a bit of a wink and a nod, say, well, we have the jurisdiction to investigate any company that trades on the New York Stock Exchange, because, of course, the New York Stock Exchange is in our region. And so this resulted in, I think, some friendly competition with some of the other offices who would say, how come you guys have opened an investigation on this company that's headquartered out here in Los Angeles or some faraway place? And we would say, well, you know, that company trades on the New York Stock Exchange. That's in our region. And so that's why we've opened the investigation. So there were no hard and fast rules, but we were and I think took some pride in being very aggressive about trying to prospect for good leads and good cases. And we would always be able to find some kind of a jurisdictional nexus because of, you know, New York's importance to financial markets.
Could you tell me a little bit more about that prospecting activity? And the question of how enforcement brings cases, of course, of great interest.
Sure. Yes. Well, there are a number of different ways. Of course, the exam program sometimes kicks off various leads when the examiners go in and they find things of interest. Sometimes there are referrals to enforcement. But I have to say there was enormous amount of resourcefulness among the staff. We had a terrific guy, Martin Kupperberg, who is the head of our broker-dealer enforcement division. And he was so skillful. He would be talking with the policymakers in Washington all the time. He was, you know, very connected with the broker-dealer world. He had his ear to the ground. He had a great nose and a sense for wrongdoing. So I can remember many times he would come into my office with kind of a smile and a grin, and he would say, I've got a terrific deal for you. I'm going to make you 20% guaranteed interest on an investment. And I'd say, Martin, what are you talking about? And he would have found some, you know, bogus investment mm-hmm. that was being flogged or promulgated, where people were being promised, you know, unreasonably large and high returns. And Martin would know right away, he would have a sixth or seventh sense that this was a fraud. Mm-hmm. So he would quickly open the cases, and he had very, very good instincts on that. And frankly, I think the staff found and learned a lot of things simply by carefully and closely reading the newspapers. So they would read the newspapers, and there were oftentimes very kind of telltale signals that they would come up with by just a simple, careful reading of the newspaper, of something that would catch their eye and cause them to say, we should kick the tires here just a little, but we should ask a couple of questions. How is it? The easiest situations would be what caused this big loss? Somebody has just reported a big loss, and they were just giving rosy projections, you know, mm-hmm. 3-4 months ago. But in some instances, there were also cases where there were unexplained gains. And I remember the Jet case, the case involving Joseph Jet, who had a brilliant, so he said, trading strategy at Kidder Peabody, was making enormous amounts of money, and no one could quite understand what the basis for this. So I think we learned that not only do you take a close look when people are losing money, but sometimes it's useful to take a close look at when people are making a lot of money too, and it's not entirely clear what the reasons and the strategy that has led to that are.
How often do things like tips become involved in the process?
Tips are a very important part of the case selection process. Now, mind you, we would get an awful lot of tips that were simply dead ends, mm-hmm. that weren't valuable tips. But certainly there were a number of situations where we would have people that would write to us or call us with a complaint, which we would follow up, and some were quite meritorious. And we also found that many of the responsible firms, the Wall Street firms, large firms, would come to us and self-report things that they had found. Perhaps one of their traders or salespeople had done something wrong, and they took the matter into their hands, perhaps fired the person, but felt that they needed to self-report this, and that was always appreciated as well when the firms would step forward and self-report.
Okay. Are there particular cases that you recall that stand out to you? I have a number listed here, but
it's funny that you should ask, because of course now I'm going to have a complete brain freeze as to which cases resulted from a tip or otherwise how they were.
I just meant in general, not necessarily resulting from a tip.
I'm sorry.
It wasn't a follow-up to my previous question.
Oh, I see.
Looking back at particularly significant cases from your time in the New York office.
Oh, yeah. We had some terrific cases. First one that pops to mind is the Towers Financial case, which was a huge Ponzi scheme involving, I believe it was at the time, a Fortune 500 company. And we had a very difficult time persuading people that indeed this was a Ponzi scheme. I think there was an enormous amount of fear that if we got this wrong and we were falsely accusing a legitimate company, that there could be really serious consequences. We spent an awful lot of time. The commission's chief accountant at that time, Walter Schutz, who was a wonderful, had wonderful investigative instincts, helped us and worked with us and convinced himself that this was a clear fraud. And that's what gave us the wind and the backing. And we took it to Washington, and Chairman Breeden, I think, quickly recognized us. I think some of the staff that were advising some of the other commissioners were a little bit ambivalent, but it proved to be correct. And that was an enormous case involving enormous losses and criminal prosecutions of some of the people. There was another large Ponzi scheme. There are a couple of other large Ponzi schemes that I remember. One involving this charity in Philadelphia, New Era Philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like a tooth fairy scheme. If you give $100, they will match your contribution to the charity of your choice. And everybody kind of wondered, well, where's this other matching money coming from? And they had a lot of investors in this program. I think there were some Rockefeller money. I think the former Treasury Secretary, William Simon, actually went on 60 Minutes claiming that this had been a legitimate business. And as people oftentimes said, but for the SEC's involvement, this would be viable today. Well, that was also proved to be very embarrassing for him, and it proved to be incorrect. It was a Ponzi scheme.
I ran across that in the papers, that there was a lot of resistance.
A lot of resistance.
People were being defrauded.
Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of times people, you know, they would take the position that, you know, SEC is just intermeddling here. Just over time, these investments will pay off, and the SEC should just butt out, you know, and it's the SEC that's the cause of the loss. It's not the fact that the underlying investment strategy is invalid. So that was another important case. We had some wonderful insider trading cases that had been meticulously developed with rings of trading that spanned the U.S. A Motel 6 case had defendants from California who tipped people in Texas who tipped New Yorkers, and this was fastidiously put together by Carmen Lawrence, who was just one of the stars of The Office, and her team of enforcement staff. We had a large case, again, Carmen Lawrence's area, involving Ed Down, who was the former husband of Charlotte Ford, who was a very senior, well-respected member of kind of New York society and had access to some board members of other corporations, and there was kind of a ring that met in Southampton. So there was some, you know, glamorous facts about how they got together and exchanged information. Lots of really terrific cases. The Jet case, which I mentioned earlier, where Joseph Jet had this high-flying, phenomenal trading strategy that just collapsed. And frankly, it led to the collapse of Kidder Peabody when all was said and done. That was another one of the big cases that we brought.
I ran into one action against Merrill Lynch with mispricing something called unit trusts.
Correct, yes. That was a case. It was, in my experience, Merrill Lynch was, as many firms, very, very jealously guarded, well-deserved, excellent reputation. They were really a firm, I think, that we had a lot of confidence in. They had a very strong legal and compliance group. And yet, for reasons that are no fault of a strong legal and compliance group, things happen that go wrong. And so we had an engagement with Merrill Lynch. It was painful for them to be named in an enforcement case, but we felt that the facts and the law warranted it, and we had to take what we felt was measured action in that case.
And then you were involved with an early large case against a mutual fund with the First Investors Consolidated Corporation.
Oh, yes. That's another one that was done by Rick Marshall, who we had sort of separate teams that did 40 Act investigative work that was headed by Rick Marshall, and then Martin Kupferberg did the broker-dealer cases, and Carmen Lawrence had the broadest jurisdiction of all. She could do whatever cases she wanted and did an excellent job of that. But First Investors was a large case that we brought involving sales practices, involving the sale of mutual funds, and it was developed over a number of years. A lot of very bad evidence was developed in terms of the way mutual funds had been sold by this complex, and it was one of the office's big cases.
And mutual funds is an area that some years later Arthur Levitt began to concentrate on in terms
yes.
of the governance of it. So was it apparent that there were going to be larger issues in this area that early on, or was did
it was
wisely?
It was certainly we would look at the kind of the calculators at how much money was managed and invested in mutual funds. And this was a transitional period, so no longer did mom-and-pop investors buy single shares of stock. Those days were long gone, and people would instead buy a share of a mutual fund, which would have exposure to lots of different equities. So we would see the numbers grow and grow and grow of amounts under management by mutual fund companies. It became a high priority for Chairman Breeden. He was challenged with the task of trying to provide some kind of credible inspection program over a large growing segment of the financial services industry. And how can you be credible if a mutual fund thinks that you're only going to get examined once every 15 years? You had to have a credible threat that you were going to be coming in and keeping your eyes on what the mutual funds were doing. So this was a very fast growing area back in the 90s and 2000.
Okay. And then kind of at the other end of the spectrum, there's the boiler rooms, micro caps. I read a couple speeches of yours on that, the occasional involvement of organized crime.
That's right. Yeah, that was, again, it was a different era, and some of the most celebrated boiler room cases were cases that were done out of the New York office. Mm-hmm. We had the misfortune of being very close to a lot of these places. Probably the most significant case that people will remember that was subsequently memorialized in the Wolf of Wall Street was the Stratton Oakmont case, which was this terrible bucket shop out on Long Island. I think, ironically, it was headquartered in Lake Success. And we all will remember the movie with Leo DiCaprio and Jonah Hill, who were just reprobate, morally bankrupt individuals. And it was one of the first cases that I walked into the office. That case was in full stream. And it was a very different time because there are no longer a need for a boiler room where there are large rooms with large tables and telephones, because nobody uses the telephone anymore. Everything is done by internet. But at the time, this was the way of communicating, soliciting, driving interest in a stock. People would get on the phone, cold call a lot of people and say, I've got a terrific stock we're looking at. It's about ready to pop. You can get it at the ground floor for a low amount, and I guarantee you, you know, within days, your investment's going to double, triple. And indeed, they would be able to drive the prices of the stocks up, then take all of their ownership out, sell it while the stock was high, the old pump and dump, and then the stock would crater and fall back. And this was Stratton Oakmont, Hanover Sterling. They all seemed to have names of Sterling or Tiffany or something like that that gave them a false luster. But we did a lot of those cases through the New York office.
I'm just kind of curious, what's your opinion of the movie of that? I mean, is that... Do you fear it glorifies it?
The movie, frankly, didn't focus as much on the securities aspects as it did on sort of the bankrupt lifestyle.
Right.
And obviously that was something that we were all aware of, that Bunny was going for sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and fancy cars and boats and planes and things of that sort. But the movie really didn't focus on the securities aspects or the enormous harm that it would cause people who would put their life savings in the hands of these people only to lose it. So I'm not a big fan of the movie. I do think, to the extent that it's shown as entertainment, it certainly was far less than entertaining to me when living through that kind of thing. I was not entertained by crooks basically taking away people's life savings and precluding college educations and things of that sort. So that was not something I viewed as very amusing.
Historical Society has recently done kind of a deep dive into municipal securities. And
right.
I guess you had at least a couple of cases in this area before.
Yes.
And, of course, it was Chairman Levitt's early focus as well.
It was. He came to the commission and actually focused all of us in the area of municipal securities, which was an area that hadn't really received a lot of attention. But he had an absolute nose for this. He was infallibly correct by asking us to focus in this particular area. And that is an area that bore fruit. We found there were a lot of abuses that were taking place, which Chairman Levitt was very familiar with from, his former days, and even say there's such pressure to buy tables and to give money and to make contributions and things of that for sort of reciprocal promises of business and things of that sort. And sure enough, when we scratched the surface, we found quite a few
abuses. We brought some cases in that area, as you know, and then worked very closely with the U.S. Attorney's Office to bring both civil and criminal cases in that area, which I think led ultimately...
You're talking about pay-to-play specifically?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yep. Now, of course, that was a new rule at the MSRB.
It was a new rule, but the underlying practices before the rule was enacted were clearly covered by traditional
fraud
commissions,
fraud,
10b-5 and things of that sort. So we didn't need a rule to pursue those cases and investigations. Certainly the rule was an outgrowth of some of the things that we found. Again, something that Chairman Leavitt successfully pressed for. But some of these things were just old-fashioned fraud, so we did a number of cases in that area.
Okay. Tell me a little bit how you came to the Washington office then as general counsel. How did that come about?
Well, I had an interesting conversation. I can remember very first time that Chairman Leavitt came to New York. Of course, he was a lifelong New Yorker. And, when the new boss comes to town, you want to put your best foot forward. So we had the staff ready to give him succinct briefings on certain cases. We didn't want to bore him. We wanted to make sure he met as many people as possible. And so I remember that very first day he came, and he was very gregarious. He wanted to meet as many people on the staff. He was very interested in what people were doing. He was a great supporter, I think, of the staff, and very interested in people personally and individually. And I got to know him through the early days, and I got to know him in that I would bring some, I think what he saw as some pretty good recommendations down to the commission, so he would see me present cases at the table. And, we developed a friendship, and frankly, I see him as one of my great mentors in life. He's just a wonderful person who I learned so much from, and gave me so many opportunities both at the commission and outside the commission. And at a certain point, he said, "I'd like to have you come down to Washington." There was no clear and direct role at the time, and we talked about that for a period of time. And then I think at a certain point, Cy Loren, who had been the general counsel, announced that he was leaving. And Chairman Leavitt called and said, "I'd like to have you replace Cy Loren. I've talked to former Chairman Breeden and asked, what's his thoughts? Who could take that job?" And he spoke highly of me, and I guess he had talked to some other folks as well. And so he offered me the position of general counsel and asked me to come down to Washington. I'd been in the New York office at that point from 2001. Through 2005. It was a perfect time to make a change and see some new scenery and take on a new challenge and tackle a new job. And so I moved to Washington in January of 2006 as general counsel. Very, very difficult job. Probably the most complicated, challenging job that I had at the commission, because all roads lead through the general counsel's office, and it requires such expertise in regulatory programs, enforcement-related matters, inspection matters. Everything the commission does is passed on and vetted by some arm of the general counsel's office. So it was an enormously broadening type of experience and role. Very, very challenging. I worked as hard as I've ever worked in my life to try to get up to speed and learn all the things that the general counsel's office was responsible for doing.
Sticking with the municipal securities area for a little bit more, we spoke to Paul Mako, of course, as part of that. And he was talking about moving along multiple dimensions with that. So a lot of what was done was building, he called it a mosaic of cases in order to attempt to kind of define the legal standards in this area.
I think that's absolutely right. It's a very good description of it, actually. And Paul, of course, was the first chairman of the or head of the Office of Municipal Securities, which is an office that Chairman Leavitt created. But I think one of the things that we recognize, and Chairman Leavitt was very skillful at recognizing that showing the need for reform through the enforcement process made the reform go so much easier rather than just telling people we need to do a reform. If you brought cases that clinically displayed abuses in the market or things that needed to be addressed, it made the subsequent follow-on rulemaking much more compelling than if you just tried to rulemake supposedly for people's benefit without concrete examples of wrongdoing. So we viewed the enforcement aspects of the municipal securities program is working hand in glove with the kind of regulatory and other changes that Paul Mako and his office were doing and the outreach that they were making. So it was a very seamless type of effort to try to combine and use enforcement to display areas where regulation and change was needed.
Was this a strategy that Chairman Leavitt was using in other areas as well?
He was, yes. It actually worked in the accounting and the auditing area. One of the most important programs, I think, that he pushed was the auditor independence between the accounting function and the consulting functions. And I think we saw the growing business that was accruing to accounting firms in the service area to do non-audit types of consulting and servicing. And I think the view was that that created some conflicts of interest, that firms might, for the sake of getting lucrative consulting jobs, perhaps be more complacent as auditors than they otherwise should be. It was hard to prove. I remember that Chairman Leavitt was called by the Senate Banking Committee, who was pushing back on behalf of corporate America. Phil Graham was the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee and gave Chairman Leavitt a very, very difficult time and said, well, we aren't seeing the evidence that you're talking about. And Chairman Leavitt says, well, we're seeing a lot of things that we can't talk about in the enforcement area, and Richard Walker is working on some of those things. And so, of course, the next thing that happened was Senator Phil Graham and the other members of the Senate Banking Committee wanted a briefing. And this was something that was itself very challenging because, normally speaking, we would draw the line and say that we could not share the results of non-public investigations with the Congress. We had no, Congress had oversight responsibilities, but there was no requirement that we share confidential information about investigations. And normally, arm's length was sufficient. We would simply tell the Congress, we can't discuss, this is an ongoing investigation. In this particular case, there were multiple reasons why it was in our interest to give them a taste of some of the things that we were seeing in our investigations. Just to make sure that they knew and understand and understood why it was that we held the views that we held about consulting and auditing services. So I remember we, instead of the briefing taking place on the Hill, Senator Graham said he would bring members of his committee over to the commission's office. This was also very unprecedented. The people from the Hill never came to the SEC's office. And not surprisingly, when they arrived on the given date, there were press people outside asking for questions about what they were doing and what kinds of things they were going to be talking about. Everyone knew that they were coming to hear about auditor independence issues. So I gave them, a briefing for a couple of hours. They asked a lot of questions. We had some very telling examples from cases that we were working on, which we anonymized so that no information was given about a particular person or firm. But I think very clearly they understood how some of the temptations worked and some of the downsides of allowing too close a relationship between consultants and auditors. And when they left the building, we viewed ourselves as having achieved some measure of success when the press asked Phil Graham on the way out, so did you learn anything today that changes your views on this topic? And Phil Graham, without conceding that he had heard an earful of things that should have alarmed anybody, basically said, well, there's always several sides to every story, and so we heard some things that were of interest to us today. So I thought that was about the best we could pull out of that. But again, that was an area where we had to show and make examples so for people to believe that there indeed were problems and we weren't just creating problems.
So I know that that Chairman Leavitt's primary strategy was to go after governance in these areas, for example,
yes.
Creating public representatives of the board.
Yes.
And of course, we have to wait for Sarbanes-Oxley to get like real legislation in this area. But without that prospect in view, what were some of the legal challenges being thrown at the SEC from industry if That's a good way of putting it.
Well, I have to say that in those days, unfortunately, the dialogue was not particularly good dialogue with the accounting profession, and we tried, and Chairman Leavitt, one I think one of the hallmark achievements was his ability to move this forward against tremendous opposition. There's no question about that, that we tried to improve the governance of the board that oversees the FASB, and there was enormous resistance to bringing outsiders in and shaking that up. But he was a very persistent man, and I think his instincts were just excellent instincts in terms of doing this. And we got and made a lot of progress. But oftentimes, it took, as I say, working through the enforcement process and through the policymaking process to make these things happen. And not using enforcement as a weapon. No one would ever do that. But using enforcement as sort of a illustrator of some of the issues that, mm-hmm. that existed.
Was there any prospect of rulemaking at that time?
There was always the threat. It was sort of the shot, as former Chairman Douglas said, the shotgun behind the door. We did not want to be heavy-handed in terms of creating rules and using rulemaking to do that. But I think that was the ultimate prospect that lay there. But I think that the way Chairman Leavitt liked to work was to work in partnership with the regulated industry. He tried to do that with broker-dealer firms for pay and compensation, things of that sort. I think he tried to do that with the accounting profession as well to see if we could reach mutual understanding on reforms that were needed and avoid having to dictate things that cause people just to chafe under the yoke of regulation.
Now, when you came to Washington, I think that was at the very tail end of the period when there were only two commissioners.
Yes. Yeah. Let's see. When I first arrived, I think that's right. In 2006, it was just Commissioner Wallman and Chairman Leavitt, which was a very interesting dynamic, having just two out of five positions filled. And I don't know whether it was a year later, but a short period of time later, the commission filled out. But it was mm-hmm. that raised a lot of challenges from a historical point of view. There had never been as few as two commissioners. We had to go back and do a lot of research to find out whether the commission was actually entitled to function with just two. And Jack Katz, who was then the corporate secretary, had some historical documents that we were able to make reference to, and I was able to talk with some of my predecessor general counsels who had contemplated the possibility of less than three commissioners. Now, I don't think anyone ever thought it would get down to two, but it did. And we satisfied ourselves that the commission did have the opportunity to proceed and to convene and with just two sitting commissioners, the chairman and one commissioner.
At the time in the press, this was kind of portrayed as neglect by the Clinton administration. Was that something that was felt within the commission in terms of not only that, but funding as well?
Yeah, there was disappointment that the political process did not proceed more expeditiously. I would say as a staff member, it was a bit of a sign of neglect. It was a little bit of a, you guys don't matter as much as some of the other appointment processes. And that was somewhat dispiriting. But again, I think one of the great things about the staff of the commission is they're, to a person, so dedicated in terms of what they do, that things like that, maybe they're brief setbacks, but they don't alter the enormous dedication that the staff has to doing what they're doing. Just get through that period.
Now, you came into the GC's office after the passage, I guess, of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, which I know had been divisive within the
commission. Oh, yes.
But I'm wondering if you can tell me, if you know anything about those positions, having been in New York at that time, but more, what was the impact of the legislation on the SEC's activities?
Well, it's very interesting. I had gotten bits and pieces of the very, very charged debate about the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act. It really split the commission apart before I got to Washington. I remember I would have conversations with Bill McLucas, who was then the director of enforcement, and Linda Quinn, who was the director of corporation finance. And I think they felt that the commission was in real danger of sacrificing in very, very important principles if it were to, try to support or oppose, in the wrong way, legislation that would restrict the bringing of private civil actions. And I think the general counsel at the time, Cy Lorna and Steve Wallman, perhaps had a different view, but it was very contentious debate, certainly throughout Washington, throughout the country, that led to this. I think that Chairman Leavitt, probably he wasn't a lawyer, and he didn't, I think, fully share some of the views of doctrinaire staff, if you will, that some little tweaks to language about standards for bringing a case could cause the kinds of harms that some people were saying. And I think he wanted to achieve the right resolution. I think he was a zealous guardian of the commission's priorities and doctrine, and he didn't want to do anything that would sacrifice commission position. But it was a very difficult period that led to that. So when I arrived in Washington, right, it had just been passed. And one of the things that I had to do as general counsel was to do a report on developments in the first year of the Private Civil Securities Litigation Reform Act. And that was a big challenge because it's kind of like watching grass grow. In a year's time, it's very, very difficult to make good, sound conclusions and assessments as to whether the law had somehow or another screened out viable cases that should have been brought or had increased the number of frivolous cases. It was just very, very difficult to get statistics and to draw conclusions. So we prepared a report circulated and released in a year's time, as we had been directed by the president to do, a report to the president on this thing. I have to say that it didn't reach any particularly startling or dramatic conclusions at that time, but it was something that I think was widely looked for and awaited.
Mm-hmm. Another issue was that the SEC was dealing with at this time was changing market structure. We were talking a little bit about, the internet in terms of it replacing the boiler room, but of course there's things like ATSs and all of that.
Absolutely.
And, you have a couple of regulations.
We did, yes. That was a very active period of time in terms of market regulation, in terms of changing markets. And enormous, as you said, alternative trading systems were coming to the fore. I think the whole debate about whether securities should be priced in 25-cent increments as opposed to pennies or smaller increments. Speed of trading was increasing. Enormous changes. And here the commission was trying to do its best to open the doors to new technologies, to embrace technology, but to make sure that all of the protections that investors were entitled to were not sacrificed in this kind of untested new areas. So that was an area of enormous change and regulation.
And was there a sense that you were trying to kind of take it bit by bit? You have the order handling rules and then Reg ATS, but ultimately Reg NMS is not all the way out until 2005. So
yeah,
and it was contentious even then.
It was. Yeah. There were a lot of things to take on during this period of time, and you just couldn't totally revamp and rewrite all of the rules. So you had to kind of proceed incrementally and keep making changes in the area.
And this was an area of particular interest to Commissioner Wallman.
It was, yes.
I'm talking to him tomorrow, so
I can get him. No, he was very technologically savvy, mm-hmm. And so this was an area of great importance to him.
Okay.
Yeah. He was quite, I think, foresighted in terms of technology and its, the impacts that it could have in terms of the markets.
Okay. And then at the same time, again, there's the Wallman report from his advisory committee on capital formation at the same time. Did you pronounce it NISMIA? NSMIA?
Yes, it was NISMIA. Yeah.
NISMIA.
Yeah.
And that whole area, and ultimately culminating, as I understand it, with this aircraft carrier release, or is that a different kind
that
of...
That was different. That was under, later on, Brian Lane and the Division of the Corporation Finance that tried to revamp the way that the securities offering process. And I think it was unfortunately dubbed aircraft carrier because it was, I think it was too ambitious. It was too big and vast and complicated. And yes, there was a passion to improve the securities offering process to make it easier and more streamlined. But I think that this had the misfortune of going too far and in effect creating an entirely new system rather than making incremental changes to the existing system. So I think, as history will show, that when after Brian Lane left the commission, Alan Beller came in. I guess he didn't come in right away. I think it was first David Martin. Mm-hmm. And then Alan Beller was appointed by Chairman Pitt. And, of course, he was a private practitioner of great skill, knowledge, and expertise in the securities offering area, and he was the guy that finally was able to achieve the rule changes that were really revolutionized the securities offering process.
Now, NISMI was primarily a realignment of, I guess I call it the broad exemptive authority given to the SEC versus the state regulators. I'm not totally clear on this.
Yeah, no, and as you mention it, this is one that I guess over the passage of time and the lack of continuing connection in this area is something that I probably spent less time on than some of the other matters.
Okay. Do you have much to do with the I guess it would have been in the concluding phases by the time you came into the GC's office, but the NASDAQ 21A report?
Yes. That was something also that was worked on and vigorously by enforcement, and obviously it was a hard-fought battle with the industry. Bill McLucas was the director of enforcement at the time that was brought. I think the chairman's office was quite involved in making sure that that case came to a conclusion. I think some very important changes in terms of the way that the NASD was governed. Long-lasting changes.
Did Arthur Levitt ever speak at a general level about kind of a philosophy of changing governance in various institutions, SROs, later the mutual funds, of course, the auditors?
He certainly was probably one of the most effective chairmen in history in terms of using the bully pulpit to set forth ideas and to suggest areas for change. He was a very, very gifted speaker and spoke often with real messages for change. So he didn't do speeches just to say, here's what we've done. He would give forward-looking speeches and use those to achieve change. So he spoke about all of those issues, and not necessarily together, strung together, but individually, the importance of appropriate governance in some of those areas that you mentioned.
Yeah, the numbers game is, of course, the famous one.
Oh, yes. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So is there anything else we should talk about with your time at the GC's office before we go back to your time as Director of Enforcement?
I think you've hit many of the highlights that I remember.
Okay, so then I guess Bill McLucas left after being Director of Enforcement for some time.
Stanley Sporkin used to say Bill was the Babe Ruth of enforcement because he was enforcement director for the longest period of time of anyone. He was an excellent, really terrifically, historically important enforcement director.
So it was Arthur Levitt then who asked you to...
He did. I was preparing to leave and frankly, talking to an external firm. I was, I think, in the final stages of interviewing for a job. And I told him that I was going to be doing this. Sort of a long and historically funny story. But anyway, he said, and when he knew that Bill was going to be leaving, he said, I'd really, really like you to stay to do the enforcement job. I think this is a great opportunity for you, and you can always go to the private sector some other time. And I want you to stay. I'd like you to take that job. And to be honest, I was pretty far down the road in terms of talking to another outside firm. But it somehow, I remember talking to Linda Quinn, and I talked to a couple of other people, and I said, gosh, do you have any advice for me? What what do you think I should do? This other opportunity is a pretty interesting opportunity. And really, I think most of the people turned it back on me and said, you're really going to have to search your soul and find out what it is that you really wanted to do. And I realized, I came to the realization that this was almost like a dream come true. I kind of thought, look, if this happened at this point, I've been at the commission for 6, 7, 8 years, and I've had a great run. I've had a wonderful time. And, you know, I never was a director of enforcement, but I had a terrific experience and two great jobs that I loved. But then when I sat and thought, I said, you know what? This is where my heart is. Mm-hmm. This is really what I want to do. And I will disengage from the private sector, and I will re-up in a new role, which is extremely exciting to me, something I love, and I did.
Did it seem like a return, having been here in the New York office, or was it?
It was different. Obviously, having oversight of all of the regional offices mm-hmm. was a huge step up in terms of what I had done in New York. It was great to be reconnected with my colleagues from the New York office, who I loved dearly. It was one of the most wonderful periods of my time working in New York, and I loved the people there, and many of them were still there. But nevertheless, it was brave, new, bold new challenges, too. It was a new era. There were new priorities. Nothing ever stands still. So there was a lot of new work to be done.
What were the priorities when you came in?
So one of the priorities was the entire earnings management program that Chairman Leavitt had been very outspoken about mm-hmm. in terms of companies cooking the books, basically, to present, unduly optimistic, mm-hmm. Financial pictures, or play with earnings so that they could come in just above analyst estimates in a particular quarter and have favorable treatment by their stocks. And it was something he had spoken a lot about. And by that time, again, the cases, which took a long time to produce, were sort of lagging mm-hmm. the speeches and the talking about some of the abuses, and we needed cases. We needed to show that this, in fact, was happening. And it wasn't just happening in small companies, but it was happening in large companies. So we had a lot of cases in the inventory. I don't claim any credit for having developed all of these cases. A lot of them were cases that Bill McLucas had opened, and any enforcement director gets a kind of a benefit of whatever is in the existing inventory when you walk through the door. But we tried to bring as many of those cases exemplifying different sort of ills, if you will, channel stuffing or cookie jar reserves, things mm-hmm. of those different types. And each case would have a kind of a illustrative principle that was attached to it. We tried to get as many of those cases rolled off as fast as we could. So that was an enormous area of focus and importance. And frankly, when you look back historically and see that all of this stuff was sort of immediately preceded the Enron World Cup, he was not making up the mm-hmm. fact that there were a lot of abuses that companies were engaged in. And I think we were well ahead of the game and started focusing on that area early and showing people that there were a lot of abuses here.
And Arthur Andersen got its first ding in this period, too, well before.
It did, yeah. That was a case that was looked at, frankly, very much as a sort of an auditor-independent case, mm-hmm. though it was not a failure of independence was not charged, but it certainly permeated the entire order that this was a company that had a very lucrative consulting business, and they were making decisions on the audit side that we felt were influenced by mm-hmm. some of the audit work. I mean, some of the consulting work and the desire to keep the client happy. But the case focused purely on, misconduct in connection with the audit. But that was a very, very significant case.
In your experience across your time at the SEC, what are the particular challenges of bringing an investigation or an enforcement action against a large company or a large broker-dealer?
Certainly, you have to be fair, mm-hmm. and the SEC's process is, I think, more fair and more exhaustive than any other law enforcement agency. People don't understand, and I think give the SEC enough credit, and frankly, it may be a bit of an albatross for the SEC. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. attorney, for instance, when they want to indict someone, they don't need to have a commission of five people consider it and vote on it. The U.S. attorney has the absolute right to decide to indict or not to indict. Now, there are some exceptions of cases that have to be heard by people in Washington if it's of such systemic importance. But by and large, individual decisions can be made quickly and usually are by a U.S. attorney or an individual law enforcement person. Within the commission, the process can really bog you down. The process is designed to ensure fairness to people, which it does, but the joke was that more time and more arguments against bringing a case were made from people within the commission during the process of getting a case approved than were made by the lawyers for the party that was ultimately charged. So you would have commissioners with each two or three different legal assistants looking for ways to challenge the enforcement division, looking for little hooks of things that they thought were wrong. You would have all of the different divisions with substantive authority in a case, Division of Corporation Finance, Investment Management. They would have teams of people analyzing the theories and the facts and trying to figure out whether this was the right case to be brought. So historically, when a case was approved by the commission, so many of the staff would issue a huge sigh of relief, like, wow, we won. And I would constantly have to remind people, you're just starting. You've just gotten authority. You now have to prove this case. You have to win this case. So don't think of it as being over, even though it feels like running the gauntlet sometimes. But as I say, I think overall that is an enormous important characteristic for the way that commission's processes work. There's lots of time and opportunity for engagement. And certainly when you're dealing with a regulated entity that's a not only just a large employer, but has responsibility for customer funds and accounts and things like that, you've got to be cautious and careful and make sure that you've got your facts right, you don't, you know, pull the trigger when you shouldn't, and that you make sure that everyone's well protected.
When you're attempting to get in a case approved like that, it's very interesting. To what extent is that about opinions of the winnability of the case, and to what extent is it opinions about the policy, the enforcement policy of the commission?
To be honest, winnability is, I believe, probably of lesser importance than the policies and the principles. And going down in flames for something that you believe is right, I think there is no shame, and there's never any looking back. If you proceed with a case that you think is factually and legally supported, that supports an important policy or principle, and if you lose, there's some cost because, of course, the external world tallies your statistics and is constantly saying, oh, you know, you only have a 60% success rate in cases that you brought in federal court. But I think internally it's a very principled type of decision. Certainly you, in the fairness requires that you have to look at the evidence and make sure that you have the evidence that you know, supports your supports your case. And you have to make sure that you're not stretching or bringing legal claims that aren't well supported.
I wanted to ask you specifically about the impact of the O'Hagan case, which, of course, was argued when you were GC, but also about the effect that it had on being able to bring cases under the
misappropriation
theory.
Well, look, the O'Hagan case was probably the single most important case while I was at the commission because, of course, as you know, the case law on insider trading, there was never a specific statute. It was something that grew up and was validated by courts under 10b-5. And the theories grew over time. There was the classical theory of a direct tip by a company insider. But then there were the whole category of cases where it wasn't a company insider that was portraying the information. And that, of course, gave rise to the misappropriation theory. And O'Hagan was about as good and as juicy a case as you could hope for on the facts to try to sustain why this was, you know, should be something that's illegal. And it was argued brilliantly by the Solicitor General, Michael Dreeben, who was, I think, Assistant Solicitor General, Paul Gonson, who was a very distinguished senior solicitor at the commission at the time, sat at the council table when this happened. But mind you, this was something that was of the utmost importance to the commission's enforcement program, because if the O'Hagan case had been decided the other way, and that had cut out an entire, you know, leg, a very important leg of our enforcement program, I think we all recognized we had to do something about that. And I think in the past, when Harvey Pitt was the general counsel, he had drafted proposed legislation for insider trading to make it illegal. And part of that legislation, of course, incorporated the misappropriation theory, so that would have been deemed to be the law. But ultimately, that draft legislation lapsed, was never taken up, never considered. But I think out of an abundance of caution, I was asked to dust that off, get that together, be ready very quickly to go to the Hill if we lost O'Hagan. And of course, the private bar, the ABA types were all predicting and prophesying that we were going to lose this case, and the Supreme Court was going to mop us up, and they were all quite confident that we were going to lose. And I remember I was on a trip in California. I had some sort of a conference that I was attending. I had to give a speech at when the case was decided. I remember I was on the plane, and I knew it was going to be released a certain day. When I landed in California, I learned the news that O'Hagan, in fact, had been affirmed, and it came out in our favor. And I was desperately trying to get, you know, little tidbits of what the opinion had said.
How many justices affirmed it?
I believe it was 6-3, but I could be wrong about that. It was 6-3. So it was an enormous victory, and that we therefore shelved the draft legislation, put that away again. We decided that we had now established this theory with significant and reasonable concreteness. We didn't need to have legislation, and so we thought the legislative process can be quite perilous. There can be a lot of mischief in the legislative process where people will get in and try to do little tweaks to the legislation that will actually provide harm to the program. So we thought the case was very clear in terms of explaining what the misappropriation theory was all about. And we were delighted.
So you've been able to bring cases under the misappropriation theory before O'Hagan, of course.
Sure.
Was there increased success afterwards with that?
Yes. Well, I think unquestionably that took away. There was always the hope, because the misappropriation theory had never been, you know, expressly validated by the Supreme Court. It had always been sort of, we leave for another day. And yet the courts of appeal had upheld, you know, cases based on misappropriation theory. But this was, a real challenge and a test. And there was some thinking that that it would be eviscerated.
Okay, so then after that, a few years, is Regulation FD. So
right.
How does that impact the terrain?
Well, Regulation FD was, I think, again, something that Chairman Leavitt led the charge on with Harvey Goldschmidt, who by then, I think, was the general counsel at the time, and designed, as you know, to address the question of selective disclosure of companies selectively giving tidbits of information to favored analysts who would then have an informational edge over the rest of the market. And that was not deemed to be a healthy, desirable practice. It was extremely contentious at the time. Companies reacted violently against it, felt that it was going to chill disclosure and communication. I think the commission took the position, no, it's just simply saying whatever you communicate, you just have to communicate to everybody. And I think the feeling was that the market would impose its own disciplines, that companies that disclosed less to the marketplace would be penalized in terms of their share value, because shareholders would say, this company isn't as open and transparent as that company, and as between the two, I want to invest in the company that's more transparent telling us information. There was, though, of course, the fear that this regulation was going to be used as kind of a gotcha to bring enforcement cases that were warranted.
In this case, is this one of these cases where this was one of the policy calls of the commission where you would not bring an insider trading case against, say, for example, an analyst who had traded on the basis of data that had been selectively disclosed?
No. It was, I think we would have if we had the case, if it was, you know, confidential information that was obtained in a relationship of trust and confidence, all the indicia, I think we would have brought the case. Okay. But I think what we wanted to assure the corporate and the issuer community is that we weren't going to be looking for sort of footfalls and people tripping wires, you know, inadvertently. This wasn't going to be something where they were at their peril in deciding what to say and what not to say, that there was a reasonably clear line that, you know, material information needed to be disclosed kind of, you know, uniformly, but that we weren't going to be playing gotcha with people. And there was a lot of skepticism about that. I think I gave a couple of speeches towards the end, trying to provide, calm the waters and tell people, you know, judge us by what we do and not by your fears. Work with us on this. This is something that, from a policy point of view, is extremely important. And I think that, that the commission did establish a pretty good track record that it when it brought cases where there were some really strong, compelling facts that people would say, well, I certainly understand why that case was brought. And it has never been, and I think that the corporate community is now reassured that this isn't just going to be a, you know, enforcement weapon and tool that's used indiscriminately. So there needed to be some calm sprinkled over the roiled waters to make sure that people try to, you know, use best efforts to follow this rule. And not to clam up and basically say, well, the safest thing to do is just to say nothing. We'll just not make disclosure, because that's not realistic in an internet world. You've got to constantly have communications going to the marketplace. But that people should be much more encouraged using the internet and other tools to make broad disseminations, you know, publicly and simultaneously in a quick fashion. And that's certainly the way that the world works today in terms of the internet and, you know, public disclosures. They're just, you know, instantaneous. It's not done through publication in the conventional sense and mailing information to people. It's done by internet releases.
On that note, I talked to Linda Thompson a couple of years ago, and she said that, you know, even after the passage of Reg FD, there was a little bit of a grace period so that people could get used to exactly what the requirements were.
Yeah, that's right. I think this was an area where, obviously, we weren't not going to just turn our back on abuses, but I think we were going to try to administer this in a way that was responsible so that people just didn't get further agitated. There was an awful lot of agitation. I think people decided, okay, we have considered all of the arguments, pro and con. We've made some changes in the regulation to adapt to what people said. But overall, we think it's important. And today, the debate still exists as to whether this is a good or a bad thing. I think it's actually been a very positive rule.
And returning to something that we touched on before, which is scams over the internet and that sort of thing. There's actually an Office of Internet Enforcement that's created in this period.
One of my proudest developments, and there was a very tech-savvy staff member named John Stark, who had, Bill McLucas had, I think, sort of turned him loose in the internet area. And by the time I became director, I felt that it was time to actually sort of dignify the works that he was doing and the people that were working with him, and to create an Office of Internet Enforcement. They, believe it or not, even as short a time ago as 1998, you know, the use of the internet for investment purposes was still, you know, beginning. It was in its early stages. I think we all had seen the migration of some of the old scams from the boiler room type of environments to a new, simple, much easier media. You didn't need 50 people sitting at desks. One person with a keystroke could could get communications out to the same number of people that you could reach by 50 people picking up the phone and calling. So we thought it was very, very important to make sure that we had a very vigorous presence and were policing the internet for fraud, and there was an awful lot of it. There still is a lot of it today. But we just did not want to have people think that this is the easy new way. Now that they're cracking down on the boiler rooms, they're sending out the fraud squads, there's FBI and things of that sort, I can do this in the comfort of my living room and avoid all of those risks. We didn't want people to think they could do that. So we were quite aggressive in terms of doing some internet sweeps. We would focus on particular types of cases, whether it was touting of securities, making false statements, predicting the success and receiving some money or things of that sort, and to highlight some of the recurring problems, which I think was got a lot of attention at the time. We also brought a lot of the sort of the pump and dump type of cases where people would use the internet to build up the price, then get out, and then to see the price collapse, have the price collapse.
Okay. Another thing that I wanted to ask about is the coordination of enforcement and civil criminal prosecution.
Yes.
There's this extraordinary case, Operation Uptick.
Operation Uptick,
in particular,
yes.
That I'm wondering if you could
tell us. Yes, we had an excellent partnership with the Department of Justice, in particular Mary Jo White in the Southern District of New York. They were excellent partners. We worked very closely and effectively with them. They showed the commission and its staff great respect, worked in a very effective way. Commission was more effective in doing some things, and the U.S. Attorney's Office was more effective in doing it. And there was a clear and good understanding of how to work together. The Operation Uptick and then before it, Operation Thorcon, were brave new steps in terms of the cooperation between civil and criminal, in that we, for the first time ever, were involved with undercover operations by the FBI over which we didn't have full control. And the commission was very restricted in terms of the way it could get information, in terms of the notifications it would have to give to people that it was seeking information from. Basically, I work for the Securities and Exchange Commission. The information you give me could be used for thousands of purposes and things of that sort. FBI was not so encumbered. And I think there was enormous debate within the commission about whether this exposed the commission to unnecessary risks, that if we were involved in some undercover operation, the FBI went and did things that we wouldn't be allowed to do necessarily by ourselves that created investor harm. So in other words, sometimes to pursue an undercover operation, you actually had to sit and observe a fraud. And that was something that gave the commission a lot of fear and trepidation that we, you know, are at great risk if we allow a fraud to happen and don't stop it. But we put in enough safeguards into the thing. We had a great memorandum of understanding, protocols of things that we were comfortable with the FBI doing, things we weren't comfortable. And it was a great partnership that led to a series of really great cases, and some involving, the criminal underworld.
Right, organized crime.
Organized crime, which is, of course, a topic that everyone was enormously afraid of. There was a lot written about it, the underworld and organized crime taking over securities. Mm-hmm. My own personal view was that that was somewhat overstated, but there was certainly and clearly evidence that there were the underworld and organized crime was involved in some securities activities. I never thought it was of such a large extent that some seem to believe, but this was very, very effective in terms of a joint team effort between Department of Justice, FBI, and the SEC.
I always say this, it's mainly at that micro-cap level.
It was the lowest of the low, yes. Right, the micro-cap, the sort of cockroaches of the world, you know, that were causing so much harm to unsuspecting investors with just penny stocks and those micro-cap stocks just above the penny stocks.
Is this when you first met Rob Kuzami?
Actually, I met Rob Kuzami at my old law firm. So we worked together as litigation in Cadwalader, Wickersham, and Taft. And I have one vivid recollection of Kuzami that involved a takeover case. There was a threat to one of our clients by a person who we thought was close to organized crime and had been involved in a lot of securities-related frauds. And on a rainy weekend, we were getting ready to bring a temporary restraining order, and we needed to come up with a RICO claim against this group. And we kind of thought, this is actually one that may really work, because these individuals that are trying to take over our client, they've actually been had some convictions for mail fraud and wire fraud, and we can put those things together as predicate offenses and make this into a convincing RICO claim. The problem was RICO was a very complicated and technical statute, and on this rainy weekend, I realized that Rob Kazami had done some work in this area before, and someone said, you're going to just have to call him. He was busy moving apartments in Brooklyn. I said, Rob, you're going to have to come in. I need someone to draft some RICO claims for me over the weekend, which he did and did a good job of, and actually it was a successful job. But that's where I first knew Rob. But I worked with him also when I was at the SEC. He was the head of the Securities and Commodities Fraud Task Force at the U.S. Attorney's Office. We had a, as I think I mentioned, a brisk partnership of doing cases together. So we've known one another for a number of years.
Terrific. Is there anything else during your enforcement period that we haven't covered?
I think you've hit, I'm okay. Sure I'll think of, oh, great old stories the moment you leave, but I think that's a pretty good summary.
Okay, so then it was you spent about 3 years there, and then you decided that then was the time was to go back.
Then was the time. So, in fact, you know, I had served very happily under three different chairmen. Mm-hmm. Well, two different chairmen at the time. First, Chairman Breeden, and then Chairman Levitt left, I think, in February of 2001. And I thought at the time, this is the right time, because if, in fairness, a new chairman is coming in, either I have to re-up for a substantial period of time, or else I have to tell the new chairman that I'm planning on leaving. And I thought that after 10 years, the time was right to make that part, you know, to make a change. I was just turned 50, and mm-hmm. I think I was pining away to return to New York a little bit too. So when Chairman Pitt was appointed, I went in and I said, look, I knew Chairman Pitt because he was an active practitioner before the commission, so we had always had a good relationship, and he was extremely gracious. He told me he would like very much to have me stay, but he understood that my thinking was it was the time to mm-hmm. to go, and I said, I'll help you during the transitional period, but my my goal is to leave, you know, in September. So I left in September.
Was that before Enron hit, or was that
right before Enron?
Right,
yeah,
before,
exactly. I know. And as I think about it in retrospect, obviously, had I it just been a couple of weeks shy of Enron, had I been there when Enron hit, then there would have been another 5 years, right, at Tactile, because you can't leave, you know, when something like that is happening with an Enron and a WorldCom and all that whole string of cases. Mm-hmm. You stay and you tough it out. And to be honest, that would have been a good thing. That would have been a very interesting period in history and an exciting period, and I'm sure I would have had no regrets. But it also did make my decision. I think it helped validate that, because yeah. there was just a whole new chapter for a new director, and that was Steve Cutler.
Okay, so how did you decide to come then here to Deutsche Bank rather than, say, a law firm?
Well, I think I talked to some law firms, and to be honest, the prospect of going back to private practice, which had become you know, very business-focused and lawyers constantly hustling for clients, that's not something that appealed to me particularly. Mm-hmm. And I spoke with Deutsche Bank, and it struck me that there was a big, broad opportunity. They were expanding rapidly as an investment bank in the securities area. They were looking for someone to create a kind of a global fabric to their legal department. They mm-hmm. had what I would call a sort of a series of colonies, you know, very well-established groups of lawyers in different locations, but they didn't have someone who had kind of strung it together and made a global team out of it. And that was a very exciting possibility. That was not possible to do at some of the other firms because they already had it. So there was a very exciting, interesting opportunity at Deutsche, which caught my attention, and that was what I chose to do.
Now, you had about a bit of bad press about this a few years ago, I know. Now, personally, I'm not... I find the reporting of Matt Taibbi a little frustrating in that he tends to rely on associations and the scene shooting and that sort of thing. But at the same time, there's deeper questions about, like we were discussing, about the SEC's ability or willingness to bring cases against big firms and all that sort of thing. Propriety, which stung Harvey Pitt a few years ago in terms of William Webster's association with this audit committee. And so I'm wondering if you can address
Look, I think one of the great things is that the commission's ethical responsibilities are taken very, very seriously by most of the staff. And there's a during my time, a woman named Barbara Hannigan, who I think is now the chief ethics officer over at the PCAOB. But she was terrific because she was... You could go to her, you could get very clear advice about what you could and couldn't do and how to protect yourself. And so when the investigation involving Deutsche Bank started, I had not hadn't been approached by Deutsche Bank. And sometime during the course of the investigation, I was. And I concluded, of course, immediately I couldn't have a decisional role with respect to whether or not to bring a case against the bank or not. And I delegated it to others. And so the Rolling Stone article, I was stung by. I thought it was very unfair, particularly because it was it came more than 10 years after I had left. And after 10 years of time, trying to get people with the recollections of, of what had happened and what I did, it was just very, very difficult to do. But the Inspector General did a full and a fulsome investigation and issued a report, finding that I had not acted inappropriately and there was no appearance of impropriety to anything that I had done, that no decision had been made by me with respect to ultimately bringing or not bringing a case against Deutsche Bank. So I was happy to be fully exonerated by the Inspector General. But obviously that is never reported after the fact. Right? Right, reported is the headline that, you know, look at this funny situation where Walker, you know, the commission is doing an investigation. And I think they quoted some unnamed members of the staff, again, why 10 years later, who were disgruntled and thought it was, you know, odd. But the Inspector General did the investigation, and I've had, and I was fully vindicated.
Are there standards, explicit or just general practices, about who an SEC member can join after leaving the SEC in terms of who's been investigated and that sort of thing?
I don't think so.
I know there are restrictions on being able to go back and
There are restrictions on activities, right? Yeah. There's restrictions on how to whether you can or cannot appear before the commission and on what matters. But I'm not aware of any restrictions on actual. I'm not sure by the time. Frankly, I think that the decision whether or not to proceed against Deutsche Bank was I wasn't involved in it, but I think it may have been made after I left. So I don't even think it had been made at the time.
Okay, so then tell me then a little bit. You've had two positions here,
right? So my first position was the general counsel of the corporate investment bank, and that was a very clear and direct mandate: develop a seamless global team that faces off against our business the way we operate. And at the time, as I say, this was a period of enormous build out of our investment bank. And global, 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 this was the mantra. Everything had to be global. We don't operate regionally, we operate globally. And the criticism, if there was one, was that the legal department was kind of trapped in the past, that they operated regionally, and what there needed to be was more of a global fabric. So I put together an organizational structure that was global in nature, got great people to assume roles and promoted some people from within to roles. And we had a great great start with that group. Over time, the bank acquired a large asset management business that was located in the United States. So I think the decision was made, given my background, I was well suited to provide legal support to this group, not just the investment bank, but the asset management part of the business. So my duties expanded. And then when the other person who was a senior legal officer for what we called the corporate center and for our retail business, which was German-based,
retired, then the entire responsibility for the legal department came under my remit.
I've spoken to a couple of people at the commission about negotiating the differences between international accounting standards in particular, but also regulations. I'm curious what that looks like from the inside, if you can speak in general terms about that.
So, look, outside the U.S., there isn't a process like the process that exists mm-hmm. at the commission. And I think enforcement is not something that has been a sort of mature process at many regulators. This certainly has changed over the last year, and you're seeing a lot more international enforcement than you did 10 years ago. But I think the commission has always had the virtue of a well-defined process, well understood and recognized, no surprises. People know how to engage with the commission. They know what the protocols are. They know about the Wells process and the rights that you have for that. And that just wasn't as nearly as well defined outside the U.S. Mm-hmm. I think the commission is widely feared. It is recognized that they are an aggressive and vigorous an enforcer. And so oftentimes, I think my colleagues outside the U.S. would be rightfully fearful of what was happening at the commission. But then, of course, given the emergence of local regulators like the Elliott Spitzers and, you know, others of that ilk, the fears were soon transferred not just to commission enforcement but to some of the other more local enforcers that existed. But it certainly was an interesting phenomenon looking from the eyes of foreign clients back into the United States and trying to assess the fairness of our process. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people outside the U.S. said, well, that's just a highway robbery, that's extortion, it's a stick-up, mm-hmm. and this is unfair. So there was quite a bit of explaining as to how the process worked and trying to rationalize it. There's some things that, frankly, were unfair that I couldn't. But it was interesting to also see the reactions of other regulators to what was going on and happening in the U.S. as well, because mm-hmm. I think the U.S. has always been deemed as being quite aggressive when it comes to enforcement as compared to enforcement in other parts of the world.
At the SEC, of course, you mainly just have to be concerned with things within the ambit of the SEC, although that's become more complex since the year 2000, really. But you have to deal with this patchwork of regulators when you're
That's working. The biggest difference is that you've got this concurrent jurisdiction, and it is impossible to rationally explain the U.S. system in which at one time I think there were 7 federal bank regulators, 50 state regulators. Now there's a Consumer Protection Bureau, there's CFTC and SEC. Which in no place else in the world is that jurisdiction divided. And the multiplicity of regulators with overlapping and concurrent jurisdiction in the United States is singular. There is no place else. Most places have sort of the two-tier system where you have a prudential regulator and then a conduct regulator, and no opportunity for sort of the pile-up of, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 different conduct regulators, you know, piling on for the same set of facts. That's mm-hmm. unique to the United States.
Now, of course, we're speaking in the shadow of the LIBOR settlement here.
Not necessarily the shadow yet. No. I think the sun still is, feeling very much on my neck.
I expect so, yes. Well, one thing I'd like to ask you in general, I'm sure your ability to speak candidly about details is somewhat limited. But what does compliance look like in general with it? Like how is it structured within an entity of this sort?
Compliance has become an enormously challenging role at all of the banks. I think there is a gap between what's expected of compliance, what they can reasonably and effectively do, and what they're held accountable for doing, which I think has got to be bridged somehow. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, compliance, they're in the unenviable role when something goes wrong, there's almost a knee-jerk reaction, well, why didn't compliance stop that? And that can never be and cannot realistically be the function of compliance. Compliance can do many things to help wrongdoing, but it cannot be the first that's accountable when something goes wrong. It cannot be because of a compliance failure. It's first and foremost a failure in the front line, the first line of defense, the business. So compliance has become a very challenging role, very specialized role. I think what we're seeing increasingly is the splitting apart of compliance and legal. It used to be that legal and compliance, you know, we're all housed under one roof, mm-hmm. but increasingly I think the duties are now divided, so that compliance has its delegated, designated duties, and legal has its delegated, designated duties, and there's close partnership between the two, but an evolving model.
In this time, you know, technologically speaking, I mean, how much of this takes place, through technology surveillance of people working within the company? How much of it is dependent on people?
Yeah. I think it's both. And certainly technology is vitally important and can be so useful in terms of looking at patterns and activity and exception reports and things of that sort. But by the same token, the human touch, the analytical insight is should never be lost track of. I think what several years ago we tried very much to what we call would operationalize our compliance department by having it run just like you when you get your physical these days. You say to the doctor, "Well, how am I doing?" And he'll say, "Well, I'll call me on Thursday. I'll get 17 blood tests, and then I'll tell you how you're doing because all the numbers will tell me how you're doing." And I think we made some mistakes in thinking that you could run a compliance program by the numbers and by the reports and by all of the informational types of things without kicking the tires, getting to know the people, doing some human interface and interaction as well. And so I think there's been a movement back to some combination of both, certainly trying to use technology to the fullest extent, but also trying to have human interactions too.
I'm just curious, speaking generally, having been 10 years in public service and then being in this position, not only in this position, but in the center of this huge whirlwind of a scandal, what are your general impressions, your, emotional reaction to all that?
If
that's the right
thing. It's painful. I think I see a lot of things that I think I and the bank just deeply regrets, just bad conduct that, rightfully is the subject of, enforcement and has to have consequences with it. It's shameful, some of the conduct, some of the excesses that existed. It's just a sad period. By the same token, there has to be some positive energy and momentum in moving forward. And our bank, and I think every bank, is an enormous construction site these days. People are trying to fix as rapidly as possible, improve systems and controls, make sure that nothing that would trigger a financial crisis of the like that we've seen ever happens again. So there's enormous dedicated work going on to try to make things better and improve things. But certainly, it just doesn't feel like the sort of the pinata being whacked and whacked and whacked is at an end. It just seems like the price continues to go up and up and up and up. And so hopefully we'll work our way through this.
The German regulators, I believe, have called for your head personally.
No, they have. That's very, very painful to go through that, yes.
All right. Well, let's see. I guess let's end with maybe something a little bit more positive. And could you discuss your having been in a law firm, having been at the SEC, and having worked for a private corporation? Could you tell me about how those different perspectives have meshed, in your performance of your different jobs as you've accumulated them?
Sure. I think that there's certainly valuable things you learn in each of those things that contribute to making you a better and better rounded lawyer. And also the ability to listen to what someone with a different point of view has, to have been in the position where you might have shared that point of view or you might have understood what led to a different point of view helps immeasurably kind of narrow some of the gaps that exist in the discourse and the dialogue between the regulated and the, you know, the regulators and things of that sort. I think also from the private sector, when I moved to the government, I knew the kinds of things to look for. I knew the kinds of games that existed in litigation. I knew how to deal with some of those effectively because I'd been on, you know, the other side and on the defense side, and that I think informed my views on how to be an effective prosecutor. And then, you know, certainly the whole period within the commission, which is so many valuable lessons that you learned that hopefully you bring back with you to your a new role like I now have at Deutsche. And I've had many, many opportunities to sort of talk about tone from the top and important value-based things, which frankly are very well received by people at the firm, including people at the most senior management levels. I think I have the ability and the credibility to be able to give sort of thought-provoking talks about what people need to do to improve the culture and to improve the tone from the very top, because that is quintessentially what it takes to build a strong culture. It has to come from the top of the organization and be pushed down. And I'm a firm believer of that, and a sort of a tireless champion of trying to help people do that and reach the right notes.
All right. Well, if there's anything else you'd like to mention, please do. Otherwise, I think I'm to the end of my list of questions.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time. I've enjoyed our discussion.
Thanks. I have too.
All right. Thank you.